homepage under Community Events.
This is Bill McKibben coming at you on KBOO Portland, Oregon.
Good morning. This is Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm here with hosting a Wednesday Talk Radio. And today we're talking about criminalizing Native dissent. And that music that we just played in was from Sharon Birch. She is Navajo, and that song is called Mother Earth. And I chose it because I really needed to hear something sort of healing before we begin this discussion. It's a pretty... there's going to be a lot of discussion of violence against Native people and Native bodies. And so I wanted to play a healing song to start that out with. Our guest today is Tracy Molina, our first guest, and our second guest is Clee Benally, and both Native activists. And Tracy, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Hi, good morning. So you were actually... assaulted by Portland police on Saturday at the Patriot Prayer rally, right?
Yes, on Saturday, I was pushed or shoved really hard and tackled by, I don't know, 7 cops. It's not the first time it's happened to me. It's the first time that it's been reported by a news camera, so... This violence against us has been going on for a long time. Well, as everyone knows, it's been going on ever since they got here, since 1492.
Yeah, I think
I also got 3 charges for, I don't know why they charged me, but I got 3 charges.
So you were protesting the Patriot Prayer in downtown Portland on Saturday. You're a Native veteran, an activist, and you were charged originally with second-degree disorderly conduct, and attempted assault on a police officer.
Right, and interfering with a police officer.
That was the extra charge that was added later.
Right.
And you're facing up to maybe 2 years in jail?
Yeah, if they ran consecutively and they gave me the max, I mean, it should end up with nothing, but it potentially could be a year or more in jail.
Mm-hmm. But and in the video, that I've seen online, and there's a link on the website to this video, and in it, it looks like the police officer just charged you and grabbed the sign from you and actually pushed you to the ground. And then you were tackled by a whole group of police officers, all in riot gear.
Yes. Yeah. That's what happened.
Jeez. And
then they took us to, yeah. It's sad that this is normal to me. This has happened to me quite a few times. And it's always by a police officer that loses their temper.
It's in the video.
You know, I think they were mad at me, I think, because I was yelling at them to stop shooting because they were continuing to shoot at people who were retreating and out of throwing distance. So there was no reason to keep shooting them. And so I was yelling at them to stop shooting. And you saw on the news how there were serious injuries. And those flashbangs and concussion grenades, we know how damaging those can be, because we saw what happened to Sophia at Sandy Rock with her arm.
Sophia Wilansky,
and we
see
similar injuries. Yeah, similar. You know, we're going to see more similar injuries if they keep shooting those things at us.
Yeah, it was interesting to see they're using the same sort of less than lethal techniques they used on our people at Standing Rock, and the flash bang and the all of those things that really injured people at close range, and many of those things like they're not supposed to be used that closely to people.
And, right.
So, and in the video you're clearly walking away. You're not. You were actually charged with actually hitting the police officer?
With attempting to hit him, he said. He lied. They lie. They lie all the time because they get away with it, right? And so then when they figure out that they're lying with the video evidence, then they usually just drop the charges. But I don't know what's going to happen with mine. I don't know if it's just lost in the chaos or if they're really going to keep charging me. But they could charge me all they want because I have nothing but time to sit here for a trial. I'll move to Portland if I have to. I don't care. I'm not going to take a plea deal on something I didn't even do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sad that people have to do that. There's a lot of activists that have to do that because for their families or for whatever reason, there's reasons why people have to take pleas. And that's really sad because a lot of people take pleas on stuff they did not do.
And that's what I wanted to get to is the criminalizing Native dissent, using the justice system to basically trap Native activists in the justice system and as a form of injustice. I mean, I've been covering the Red Fawn case, Red Fawn Fallis, who's a Lakota woman who is now serving almost 5 years in prison. And part of it is she had to take a plea deal because she was looking at over 30 years in prison, and she was set up by the FBI. I mean, it's a way of taking, when you stand up, putting people, trapping them in the criminal justice system.
Right. And then with, I was raised in the Northwest, and then I have friends on both sides, on both sides of the borders in Canada and in Mexico, and I'll be able to cross Mexico just fine, but now I can't go see loved ones in Canada. I can't attend ceremonies in Canada. Canada won't recognize you unless you're federally recognized. You know, so that this leaves me out of being able to. I think there's something called a Jay Treaty where certain tribes can cross back and forth.
It hurts us
more than it hurts other people, right? Because everyone that has tribes close to the border goes back and forth because you have family and related tribes and related ceremonies on both sides of the border.
Yeah,
so it hurts us that way too. It violates our religious freedom, our spirituality. It violates that.
Because of course, our tribal nations existed before the border existed, and so our relationships aren't confined by the border. They don't stop and begin at the border.
Right.
And so you were describing to me how you were backpedaling and they were whipping batons at you, and that once they got you down on the ground, they basically created a perimeter of police officers who shielded the assault on you from view from cameras.
Right. You can't usually. That's their policy and procedure, right? Just as soon as they get someone on the ground, their second secondary line comes in and forms a circle around them to protect them while they make the arrest. And that blocks the camera's view of, and, you know, almost allows them to do whatever. And then claim that you're resisting or claim that you're assaulting them when you're just laying there flat on the ground.
And they were punching you.
They'll yell at you to, yeah, they'll, or there'll be like three men on top of you and they'll say, you know, to roll over, or, you know, they'll give you a command that's impossible to do. It's ridiculous.
Yeah, I think that we also saw that in the Red Fawn footage on when she was surrounded by police, by a police line of men, very big men in riot gear. And it looked like you had the same thing happen to you. These were people in.
Right.
Yeah. And you said that they were punching you and kicking you and at the same time telling you to stop resisting.
Right. Which is common. I mean, what I went through is nothing compared to what a lot of other activists, you know, have gone through.
Yeah.
They've been injured much worse, you know.
Yeah.
For me, it was like, for me, it was about the same as getting bucked off a horse, you know, that sore feeling.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's too bad. I mean, it's sad that it's that way, that we get attacked for standing up against white supremacists. You know, these people, they're not just, you know, racist Republicans. They're anti-Indigenous. You know, they support policies that hurt Indigenous people. Like, they support pipelines. They support man camps. They support when Indigenous people come to the Mexican border and ask for asylum, they support ripping their babies away. You know, these are the kind of people that we're talking about. And it's just ridiculous that Portland police attack us and push us, you know, just for standing up against that kind of hate towards non-white people, you know.
It's I saw that Police Chief Daniel Outlaw, she scolded counter protesters for their violent actions. She said this wasn't folks that were coming to march peacefully and demonstrate, sing Kumbaya, and go on their way. They came with the intent to cause problems.
Yeah. I think we came with the intent to defend the city of Portland from the violence that the Patriot Prayer people bring. You know, they bring people that are in the Soldiers of Odin. They bring in people that are in Identity Europa. They bring in the Proud Boys, and they're all hate groups, and they're all very violent.
Yeah, I just watched Frontline's piece on Charlotte's a year later for Charlottesville, and it's it was pretty clear that they. But they actually have like almost fight club things where they practice, you know, committing violence, and share videos of themselves doing violence, and she claims that if you're given an order to disperse and you choose not to, that tells me that you are there for confrontation. Do you feel that you were there for confrontation and deserve to be beat down by the police and arrested?
No, and that's ridiculous because every protest you go to, they say that. And also when they're on that loudspeaker and the echoes off the buildings, you know, I don't know about other people, but I can't understand what they're saying when they give orders on that, on the speakers. I can't. It's difficult to hear exactly what they're saying, especially when there's shooting going on.
Yeah, they were shooting the rubber bullets.
And they did that to me. Yeah, and last year, I was at a protest in June when they kettled us, and the kettles when they trapped everyone, no matter who you are, shoppers, tourists, protests, everyone into a block and hold them there. And so they did that to us, and I thought that was happening again. So when they did that kettle to us, they were telling us, you know, go this way, go that way, and then they would block us. So it doesn't make, you know, it's either they're purposely trying to confuse us or they have a communication problem within their crowd control department, because it's, you know, like. And then he also told us once at another protest to go to the middle of the park, leave this park and go to the middle of the other park, and then we did that, and then they attacked us when we went to the middle of the park.
Wow.
So what they say, inconsistent things, and it's, you know, it's difficult to know what you're supposed to what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, once again,
there's no reason why, there should not be a reason why we would have to disperse. We are protesting without a permit. The other side, Patriot Prayer, was protesting without a permit.
Yeah. And so once again, I'd like to say this is Wednesday Talk Radio, and we're talking to Tracy Molina, a Native veteran who was assaulted and arrested by the Portland police at the Patriot Prayer Rally, protesting the Patriot Prayer Rally on Saturday here in Portland. And if you'd like to call in, you can call in at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187, and be part of this conversation about police brutality. So you guys were arrested, you were actually, you know, these were male police officers, and they actually were searching your body while you were on the ground, right? And there was a Native right. woman protester who told them to stop.
That incident was in Seattle, but Portland police also will pat your body down quickly while you're on the ground. They'll roll you one side and pat one side, your entire body, all your body parts, and then roll you to the other side and do the same before they move you. And then when they take you to the car, they do it all over again. So, yeah.
It's pretty invasive. And when they took you in, you said that they took you to the gang unit?
Yeah, they took us to the Detectives Bureau, and the gang unit detectives were questioning us. Some of the other detectives might have been detectives in different departments, but yeah, I thought that was extremely weird. I was just expecting to go to jail.
And then they didn't try to.
And then while they were interrogating us together, and the two other people that were with me were thrown, slammed really hard to the ground, and it for no reason. And then they were thrown in some isolation cells the detectives have on their own floor. So when you're in the process of being interrogated and that's happening, violence all around you to people who are being, you know, slightly resisting, not want to answer questions, that makes you, I mean, it made me feel like, oh, I'm not out of danger. I thought I was out of danger. I'm not out of danger.
Wow. And they tried to get you to sign a waiver, right?
Right. That I couldn't read. And then they said if I didn't sign it, they would throw me in the cell with those other people. There's already there's police here at the, because there's a protest against police brutality this morning at City Hall, and so the police are already over there.
Okay, so you are at City Hall right now?
Yes.
Yeah, and you're going to be speaking there at 9 o'clock, right, at a rally?
Right.
Yeah, and you are expecting some of the Patriot Prayer people to come. Is that true?
Right. That was on social media. They were saying they were coming.
Yeah. So do you think the police will protect you?
No. In fact, the times I've been attacked by Patriot Prayer people, the only people that protected me were the Antifa kids. That's who protected me. That's who got me free. That's who saved me from further assault
from the police or from the Patriot Prayer people?
From the Patriot Prayer people.
So you were also assaulted by the Patriot Prayer people at the rally?
Right.
What did they do?
They grabbed, like, one time even Joey Gibson grabbed my arm. They like going after women for some reason. You watch on all their videos, you see them go after women. And like, if you yell at them, they will turn around and get in your face and say, I will punch you like a man. If you want to act like a man, I will punch you like a man.
Wow.
You know, they're very racist and sexist.
They've
said all kinds of racist stuff to us.
What did they say? Like,
they've called us savages. They've said, you know, they've asked me where I was born. There's always people in their group saying extremely racist things.
Wow. And I see that Joey Gibson lost his primary bid for Congress in Washington State. And you live in Washington State, right? You're a voter there. And
he lives in
Go ahead.
Yeah. I didn't vote for him.
Yeah. Yeah. He won very little. He only claimed 2.3% of the vote, with about far behind the other candidates. And he spent most of his time campaigning here in Portland, not even in Washington State.
Right.
So, and So you've had run-ins before with some of his followers, including that that really big Samoan guy, Tiny, who was the one who beat up someone who would take an issue with his Trump truck, chased down and beat up a young black teenager. What do you think is their, what is the effect of their presence in the community of Joey Gibson and his followers?
Well, people feel threatened, right? Because their followers hang out in Portland. Sometimes they come and they drink the night before and cause fights. And sometimes they stay that day and cause fights, and they wait for people to be walking to their cars and attack them, especially if they find, you know, counter protesters out by themselves. And see, I made that mistake once. I was went by myself to my car, and that's when, you know, they started to attack me. So it brings danger to people of color in the city and women.
The goal is to intimidate
and the LGBTQ community too. They do this.
Yeah, the goal is to create a sense of terror, of fear, just like in the days when people were being lynched. This is like a white American tradition, is keeping everyone else in a state of fear in order to rule.
Right.
So once again, this is Jacqueline Keeler, and I am hosting Wednesday Talk Radio, and today we're talking about criminalizing Native descent, and we're talking with Tracy Molina, a Native veteran who was tackled in the streets in Portland protesting the Patriot Prayer rally on Saturday, and is presently facing charges that she assaulted the police. And although the video shows a much different picture, and is, and you can join us to discuss this. The number is 503-231-8187. And Tracy's going to be speaking at 9 a.m. today at Portland City Hall at a rally protesting police brutality. What are you going to talk about there, Tracy?
We're going to talk about the use of less than lethal weapons on people retreating and following commands, and the extreme bias that the police have towards anti-fascist people and anyone standing up to Patriot Prayer.
Do you feel the police focused to a far greater degree on protesters protesting the far right than they did on?
I think they don't consciously do that. I think it's the engine of the system. You know, there's no reason to, like, you know, people shut down streets all the time. Like, if a cop pulls someone over, they'll sometimes put their car in the lane so that traffic can't get through. I mean, there's times in the city when streets get closed, and there's no reason why you can't be patient with protesters who have one insignificant block for a few hours. There's no reason to force them out. I mean, protesters get tired and leave, right? I mean, it's just ridiculous that they're not even, I mean, you know, they always think about money, so why don't they think about to be patient and to use all this force against people just trying to stand up for their city, you know?
And you said in the past that they had taken issue with you burning sage and other things at protests. The police seem to be very intimidated by that.
Right. We used, our people use copal, which is like a tree sap, and it's used like sage, you know, for cleansing, for protection. And so we were smudging one day after one of the attacks, and the police started to attack us because of it, and they were going to try to arrest us because we didn't put it out. And I told them that we can't put it out until we're done. We can't put it out because you say to put it out.
And do you feel the effect of this is to basically... Will this whole experience make you less likely to protest in the future? And isn't that the goal in a way? I mean, you see how the support of Trump, and then even at this protest, the Patriot Prayer folks were laughing, I saw, while the police were attacking anti-fascist protesters. It emboldens the right. And then...
Yes.
Do you feel that this would make you or other people less likely to take a stand?
I think people that, you know, have empathy and feel the pain of others and get heartbroken over parents and children being separated at the border and them being sexually abused while in custody, those people, their hearts are so big that they're going to come out no matter how much violence the police put on us. So I always say after every time I get arrested, like, that's it, I'm done, I'm not going to do this anymore. And then, you know, after about a week of the news or whatever, then I'm like, no, I've got to go. So yeah, I mean, eventually I will have to, because I'm like too old to be getting tackled by a bunch of men in football gear. I don't have knee pads on. I don't have elbow pads on.
I see. Yeah, you took quite a tumble when I saw in the video where he's a big guy. He just comes out, he grabs your side, he pushes you to the ground, and you're rolling for about 5 feet. And then these police come out of nowhere and they all surround you and jump on you. You're not like a really huge woman. I don't know. In the video, you look much smaller than them, you know? And and you're just holding a sign. How did you feel when they added the extra charges?
It felt to me like I was being targeted. I mean, maybe I am, maybe I'm not, but it just felt really gross to me to see other people get their charges dropped and then I'm still stuck there with charges and have to get an attorney. You know, I'm gonna have to hang out in Portland a lot.
It sounds like we have a caller.
I felt really sad that they were that petty.
Yeah. Wow. Okay.
And it's really sad they have to lie.
Can we have a caller, Kyle, on the line?
Good morning.
Morning. Hi, Kyle.
Hi, how are y'all?
Good.
Hey, you know, I watch these protests. I don't usually participate in them very much anymore because I don't want to get my head cracked open. And, you know, I represent a religion that has a head covering as a Sikh. And I don't want to, you know, that's just inviting somebody to come and beat me. But anyway, I don't do it for that reason only. I support in other ways with my money and my time in other areas. So. But, you know, I was thinking about this, and that is the police, I believe, I can't prove it per se, no one really can, but I think that they bring in provocateurs, and they bring them in their own cars. And if we need to start a service where we are filming them. Mm-hmm. We need to film them before the demonstration starts, when their cars come in, and who comes out of their cars. We want facial pictures. We want license plate numbers, we want badge numbers, everything we can get with a telephoto lens. And then we need to follow these people as they break windows and the provocateurs, you know, make it look like all those peaceful protesters are just violent, bunch of violent animals. You know, that's exactly what they want, so that they can go in and they can start with their flashbang grenades and all their heavy equipment. So I'm saying, you know, at each demonstration have like 4 or 5 people who are tasked with nothing but and holding nothing but high definition cameras with telephoto lenses on them, and then after these people do their deeds, run after them, follow them to wherever they go. I don't care if it's wherever, follow them home and get their home address. And you know, then we need to start putting together a case and getting these cops who are bringing these provocateurs in off the force. You know.
Yeah, well, I mean, certainly at Standing Rock, and I've been covering the case of Red Fawn Fallis and some of the other federal defendants there, and what the what we've seen from leaked documents and other things and FOIA requests is that there was a lot of infiltration that happened. Red Fawn's boyfriend that she met at camp was actually was being paid by the FBI to infiltrate the camp.
I heard that. That
yes,
is just
and he's the one whose gun he placed it on her right before she was arrested. And so it's
typical.
definitely that is, you know, it's not just our imagination. These things are really happening.
No, it's not.
Yeah.
Well, it's been documented time and time again. I can't remember his name. He used to write about this stuff, particularly provocateurs from the FBI back in the 60s who infiltrated the American Indian movement and caused death and destruction. Death, actual death.
Yes.
You know, and they were never charged, never found, you know.
No, so, one of them, Douglas Durham, even gave a press conference and revealed himself as an FBI infiltrator of the American Indian movement in the 1970s. And it did lead to a lot of, it really did debilitate the movement and continues to, because it causes so much mistrust. And of course, yeah, they're the ones instigating the violence, trying to encourage people to do dumb things, or to, they're doing them themselves. A lot of the leaked information from Standing Rock shows that that some of the burning and the things that were going on were actually done by informants themselves. So,
yeah,
they were definitely there. I mean, they estimate, like, at the one of the camps there, the Red Warrior Camp, almost a third of the people at the end were actual infiltrators.
Jesus, I mean,
yeah.
Really.
Yeah, so
you know, so that's where we're at, and I think that we need to start countering that with actual real investigation, with maybe even hire an investigator who's a professional to track these people and get their names, addresses, and phone numbers, and take them to the mayor, who claims to be the city of Portland's top cop, and say, all right, we need some prosecutions here. You know.
Yeah, I think that would be. What do you think, Tracy?
There has been several activist groups that have already done that, and all their pictures are online and their names, the phone numbers, where they work, and they're asking Portland businesses not to serve those people when they come here because of the terrible things they've done.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
The anti-fascists in Eugene and the anti-fascists in Portland, Rose City has done a lot of that work, and they do a lot of that work. They have people out here taking pictures.
Wow.
But you can. Yeah. I can go to the police. I can go to the police right now and show them a video of me being assaulted by a Proud Boy, and they wouldn't do anything about it.
Well, you're going to the people who would assault you to do something about your assault.
Right.
You know.
Exactly. We're fighting two. It's like us against two different teams, right? We're
exactly.
We're standing up against Patriot Prayer, but then we have to defend ourselves against
Patriot
Prayer.
And some of those boys are in the police department.
Yeah. In fact. Yes, that just came out yesterday that one of the captains of the Seattle Police Department came down with a gun, with a concealed weapon, and was at the march protecting Joey.
What?
Which is crazy.
Oh, my God. That's...
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's police officers on their side.
Yeah. Well, there was some of that revealed in the Frontline report last night as well. They found active duty military.
We totally need to clean up the cops. We totally need to clean up the criminal justice system. I mean, it has to start somewhere, and it should start at the cops. And get rid of the racists, get rid of the white supremacists out of the cop shop, you know, and put people who are dedicated professionals in there who want to do the job and help people. I'm tired of these guys that come in there that, you know, didn't get treated well when they're in high school, so they're going to take it out on everybody else by being a cop, and then they go be a cop, and, you know, they throw their bristle broom head, and they get their jarhead look, and they get their equipment on, and they're so bad. Well, it's all ego walking around. There's no person there. It's an ego. You know,
well, thank
and
you.
And that's not helpful to anybody.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much. And I know that Tracy, you need to probably get to your rally, but we're gonna we're gonna have Cleveland Ollie on now to discuss this more at the national issue. But anything more you want to add about what's gonna happen? You know, what's gonna happen in your case next?
I do have. Attorney, and I do have a legal defense fund that's on my Facebook and it's on my Twitter. If anybody wants to help donate, you know, $5 or $10 or whatever you can donate to the legal fund, that'd be great.
And what's your Twitter?
It's at Blue MAZATL.
Okay. At Blue MAZTL.
ATL.
Mazat.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then your Facebook is Molina Tracy, right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Great. Well, thank you, and we'll I will be keeping track of your case, and I definitely will be writing about it more in the future. So.
All right. Thank you for having me.
All right. Thank you, Tracy. All right. Next, we have on Cleveland Ollie. And he is a Diné activist and anarchist from the Navajo Nation. And are you there, Clee?
Yeah, I'm here.
Hi. Were you listening to that part, the last part there? Yeah.
No, I missed that part of the program.
So oh, you did? Okay.
Apologize.
Yeah. So but I did send you some information about Tracy Molina's case, and I know that you've done a, you've been arrested multiple times and faced state surveillance yourself. What advice would you have for Tracy in her case?
Well, I think that it's critical for anybody organizing against the state and corporate terrorism that is attacking our lands and lifeways, not only as Indigenous people, but all people who seek a more just and healthy world, to be really aware of the context and history of state repression from programs like COINTELPRO that targeted AIM, the Black Panthers, and many other liberation-oriented groups, but also to look at the new political environment that we're operating in and organize. You know, we have security culture, which is a, you know, practice embedded in our approach to direct action, but something that can extend beyond just and should extend beyond just, you know, organizers or activists, communities or scenes. So we understand how to engage and don't put more people at further risk. So there are basic things within, you know, understanding what security culture is, which, you know, basically is just a culture where people know and assert their rights. We establish security consciousness, knowing what behavior compromises security and how to educate others and hold folks accountable for insecure behavior. And it becomes a culture, really, when a group makes security violations socially unacceptable to the group. So oppressive behavior is equal bad security culture, for example, and going beyond that, you know, intersectionality or, you know, real solidarity is a powerful way to resist state repression for those targeted, for those incarcerated, you know, so they are not isolated. And this extends to movements like Black Lives Matter, folks resisting Islamophobia and transphobia, eco defenders, and, you know, we can look at the example of the case of Red Fawn. It's very clear. Situation. And that's sort of, you know, security culture is a broader sort of contextual organizational framework that we could use to address this. But, you know, on the ground with direct state violence and law enforcement agents attacking us, I mean, there are things that we can do strategically or before we go into actions so that way we're more prepared.
What would you recommend doing, like when you go to a protest that you know might become violent and that you might be targeted by the police, what actions can you take?
Well, the question of violence is a larger question, but some basic tips that we operate with, Indigenous Action Media, which is an organization that I work with, and we do direct action trainings, but we have some basic tips where we recommend that people don't put other folks intentionally at risk who haven't chosen it. Don't turn people over to the cops. Don't panic or act on rumors. We don't go to we don't recommend folks go to demonstrations with weapons, drugs, etc. So double check your pockets and bags, even if you don't feel like you might be faced with arrest. It's just, you know, basic practice at this point to understand that we go into these areas and they're going to be what we call red zones, where we would have a greater threat of risking arrest or facing police violence. So, you know, there's other things that we recommend, you know, to make sure that we mitigate the impacts of even tear gas and pepper spray. Because, you know, in many cases when we're resisting fascism, where there's potential for larger, in these larger actions for this kind of heavy militarized police response, we make sure that, you know, we recommend that people don't put Vaseline on or mineral oil or any kind of oil-based sunscreen because they can trap chemicals. We recommend that people don't wear contact lenses, you know, basic things like that, or things that can easily be grabbed. But I think part of it is just, you know, basically doing what was done in this the case that was addressed in the previous part of the show is to have some documentation, you know, to monitor, make sure that you're coordinating with legal observers and so forth, to have some kind of documentation, because when it's your word against the state's, and part of the effect of criminalization of dissent is to delegitimize people who are standing up for their communities and for Mother Earth, then we have to go in recognizing that that's part of the new political environment, and be prepared.
And one of the things that Tracy had said to me earlier was that she was just lucky that there was a Canadian TV news camera right behind her that recorded what happened to her, and they immediately released that online. And although she has more video taken by legal aid observers who have not released it because of they're going to use it in the court, and that shows even more violence. And but your pocket zine is called Film the Police and Know Your Rights, and so you do definitely recommend filming and so they can't undercut your integrity or your like what you're saying. They're trying to undercut our activists' legitimacy.
It's a basic way of making sure that they're held accountable to the extent that you can hold them accountable. And there are many cases where folks who have been targeted or attacked by police have had charges dismissed or immediately dropped. Because one, there was lack of evidence, or two, folks had been documenting, or somebody had been documenting in the area, and it was proven by that evidence that they didn't commit the crime that they were alleged committing. You know, there are other things that we recommend too, you know, that are real basic, and I think filming or documenting is also somewhat limited and could put potentially people at further risk. So we also recommend, you know, not paying attention to rumors, or just double checking or triple checking rumors, you know, not obviously turning people over to cops and pointing out people, not interfering with other groups, respecting diversity of tactics is very critical, not denouncing and distancing yourselves or groups from other groups' actions, because that can facilitate further risk of state repression. You know, just trying to stay calm, grounded, and avoid panic. I think one of the biggest things is just, you know, and what we try to do in direct action trainings is provide some sense of de-escalation and how to engage and stay calm and be aware, situationally aware, in these kinds of environments where there are heavily militarized forces. We also are facing, you know, fascists who are not in police uniforms, who are threatening and attempting to attack us. And so just going into those environments, being prepared and recognizing that we're fighting, you know, this is a fight for our communities. This is a fight against these systems of oppression that have a larger context of brutality against our people. So we go in expecting, you know, a fight, and we're not just victims. We're struggling to fight for our lives. And so live streaming and media issues are also another component. In the Occupy movement, there were critical issues with live streaming where at times the live streams were actually used by police to surveil and target and file charges against folks, and to disrupt and really ultimately undermine the effectiveness of the organizing. So, you know, we got to understand that we're operating in a new political environment, and what, you know, the criminalization of dissent has looked like contextually, and what strategies there are to resist it.
So once again, I'm Jacqueline Keeler, and I'm speaking to Cleve Benally, Diné activist, and publisher of the pocket zine film, The Police and Know Your Rights. And we're discussing the police violence, the Portland police violence in particular, from this Saturday at the Patriot Prayer rally, where Native veteran Tracy Molina was assaulted and arrested. You can call in and join the conversation at 503-231-8187. That's 503-231-8187. And so it's, she talked about being kettling, where they actually, one of the charges was that, not following directions, yet at the same time, they were being sort of rounded up and not allowed to leave. Police Chief Daniel Outlaw, who herself is a Black woman, she claims that the reason why that her police officers had to shoot pepper balls and flashbangs at peaceful protesters was because they wouldn't follow directions. What do you think of this whole? you've been arrested a number of times yourself. How would people protect themselves from something like that happening while they're out at a rally, or even, she was saying, it was even just people shopping.
Yeah, and we've seen this. I think the Pacific Northwest is quite familiar with, some of the new political environment regarding militarization of police, from the amazing resistance and also the state repression that matched it to some degree during the WTO-IMF World Bank protests in 99, so-called Battle of Seattle, and beyond, the anti-globalization summit movements from the 90s on to the early 2000s into Standing Rock as one of the most recent examples of extreme militarized tactics of law enforcement agents. We have to recognize that there's a hugely widening gap between state security forces and activists, or folks resisting and fight, our freedom fighters. And there's a growing normalization of the use of military forces and national intelligence agencies and private corporations that are being hired, that have taken their tactics that they've tested and they've learned from, the streets of Kabul or, Afghanistan or Iraq, and brought them back and used it to wage a war against people here domestically. And that level of intensity is something that we have to be really aware of. So, we have tips, like I mentioned before, what we can do to make sure we go in prepared, simple things like if there is an orientation before an action, please try to attend it, because usually there's a number that's shared for jail, basic things like jail support, where you can, take a Sharpie, write down a jail support line on your arm if you've never been arrested before. It's something that is basically a lifeline, so you understand what's happening, because okay. In many cases, people are, we recognize these basic militarized police formations and tactics like kettling, what you talked about, where the police will surround and isolate a group of demonstrators from the larger group, and in many cases implement what they call snatch squads, where they have teams of six or more law enforcement agents go in and arrest targeted individuals, or else they'll just arrest the whole group, which we've seen that in anti-mobilization demonstrations.
So before. I think we have a caller.
In some cases. Oh, yeah.
We have a caller, James.
Hello.
Hi, James.
Hey, so I don't know. I guess a question for the caller, for the guest. I apologize. I forgot the name.
Oh, Cleavanali.
Cleavanali?
Uh-huh.
Okay. So my question for Cleavanali is, how do we... Because I'm only catching a little bit of it here and there because my signal is cutting out as I'm getting out a little further. But how do we organize? How do we organize in a face of these fascist bullies who are being protected by the police? They're obviously checking us for weapons. when we go in there, but then they go and they stand on the side. Because that was the messed up part to me, is that they had we had just as much right to be there as they did. So, you know, like, how are they going to blame us when obviously how do we fight that? That's my big thing, because it's like, I just saw an article that said the Antifa is engaging in an unwinnable PR war with the alt-right. And it's like, at what point in history did Nazis become equal? How is this an unwinnable PR war against Nazis?
Okay. Like, Klee?
I don't know.
That's a good question. It's a good question.
And this is a critical, and thank you so much for opening up this dialogue, because this is a critical conversation that we need to have while we're engaging in this, you know, current, again, what we're calling this sort of new political environment, hyper-militarized police, and the face of open fascists. And these fights are not new fights. Anti-racist action was a very powerful force in the 1980s, 1990s, but we didn't have doxing then, right? So when we look at, you know, all the media coverage, even using cell phones and all of that going in, we have to be more cautious about how we engage in these anti-fascist fights. So just to address a couple of points, you brought up, how do we engage when, you know, weapons are being checked, when we're, going beyond what in the early 2000s were free speech designated zones into this militarized, air sphere of operation. And to me, it's just being creative. I think that we can learn from the anti-summit mobilizations in the late 1990s and early 2000s, particularly in Prague against WTO, IMF, and World Bank, where there were multiple areas and sort of tactics that were applied to approach with the specific goal of shutting down the summit. So if the goal in the streets of Portland, or the goal in the streets of San Francisco, or the goals in the streets of Charlottesville or other places, is to stop fascists from mobilizing and, in my personal opinion, would be stop them from existing in our communities, then it's to be as creative as possible. So we got to review, look at the tactics that have worked, look at the level of risk that we're willing to engage in to achieve those goals, and be as strategic and thoughtful as possible. And so in indirect action, we recommend that people group up in infinity groups, and basically...
What are infinity groups?
Either affinity groups or...
Oh, affinity groups, okay.
Folks who have a interest in engaging in some kind of action. We recommend from 5 to 25 people, sometimes less, depending on the nature of the action. And there are folks who have different roles within the larger protest. So the affinity groups can operate very tightly. They usually have their own agreements or set of sort of security protocols that they have, and very specific goals that can be coordinated with larger in larger mobilizations with spokes councils, so they can connect and operate with other affinity groups. And these affinity groups usually have somebody who maybe could be doing media work, folks who are engaging in the action, and sometimes it's basically just a glorified sort of buddy system. So we recommend that folks, when they go into action, that somebody has their name, their date of birth in case they're arrested, what kind of medications they might need, do their plants or their animals need to be, watered and fed, do the children need to be cared for, do they have specific needs regarding their gender identity, because you won't be treated the same if you're arrested, migration status and things like that. Mm-hmm. So just being, getting back into the question, though, about engaging, when we look at the kinds of weapons that fascists are organizing with, and the kinds of weaponry that the fascists in police uniforms are organizing with, I mean, everything from stingrays, which are cell phone intercepting systems where they can establish a network that spoofs a cell phone network in an area of demonstration and you know, use that.
Those data, were used at Standing Rock.
Either in real time. Either in real time or post the action for their investigations and then to disrupt your target. And so we have to act accordingly. So a lot of folks are not taking cell phones.
With the idea that somehow they're winning the PR war, you know, that somehow somehow Nazis are equivalent to fascists, are equivalent to free speech for people who are protecting a civil society. Why are we is it really possible that we could lose that now?
So we have to understand what, you know, when we look at who's mediating public relations, you know, is it our, like, independent forms of media, or is it corporate media? Because the corporate media isn't interested in fighting
fascism. And also, you know,
fascism represents the interests of the state.
But this also goes to the act of criminalizing dissent in the sense of making like you're saying, delegitimizing our voices by turning us into criminals.
Well, there's only so far that we can go to appeal to the sort of moral, you know, interest, if there is any kind of sort of moral interest of the dominant social order. I mean, legitimacy is determined by who. You know, at some point, and it's just like this sort of like rights-based framework and criminalization, who is legal, who is not legal, you know, should be really looked at in a larger context, that, as, you know, Martin Luther King and other folks before have said, what is legal is not synonymous with what is right. So I would argue or extend that, you know, and sort of reword that as, you know, what is, you know, a PR, you know, sort of like a look, you know, and move towards becoming more appealable in PR is not necessarily, you know, where we should be going. You know, we should be looking at how we're effective to our goals, you know, because what we end up doing if we look at this sort of like the measure or the standard, if it's established and set, you know, for what's legitimate and what's not, if it's established and determined by corporate media, then we're always going to lose.
Yeah.
Because the terms are controlled by them. And their
One of the callers, earlier callers, had talked about actually, you know, really following people who were being and documenting who may be actually sort of plants or people who were there to cause disruption, to make protesters look bad.
Who determines who is there to disrupt or not? Because there might be, you know, group, you know, affinity groups, Black bloc folk, who are, you know, engaged in property destruction. And I do not denounce property destruction. I support property destruction.
Okay, I have
because I've.
I wanted to play. I wanted to play one clip before we have to go. Yeah. I did interview a Black Patriot prayer supporter.
Because this is America.
Well, the Republicans do. I mean, Lincoln is the one who signed to hang 38 Dakota people. The largest mass hanging in U.S. history was from Dakota men in Minnesota, and that was signed by Abraham Lincoln. 38 men at one time, plus two later.
Why did he hang them?
Because the Dakota people rose up because their treaties weren't honored. In Minnesota.
Okay, what were they?
They were Dakota.
They were Dakota Sioux.
Dakota Sioux. They're my ancestors.
Did Abraham Lincoln have a reason to do it?
They had a reason to do it. They were starving. The treaties were not honored. Their children were starving.
So why did Abraham Lincoln hang them? Did he just do it, just be doing it, or did he have a reason?
Because they were trying to take our land.
Whose land?
The Dakota people's land.
The Dakota people. This is Dakota people land, what you're saying?
In Minnesota, yeah.
Minnesota?
Yeah.
So Minnesota does not belong to the United States, is what you're saying?
It belongs to the Dakota people.
That's not going to happen. The year 2018 is not going to go back to the 1700s. It's not going to happen.
It wasn't the 1700s. And, you know, it was...
Even before, in the 1700s, there was more Indians in this land. We all agree that.
In the 1700s,
this land, this is not going to go back to that.
If it wasn't for
Just like during the slavery time, this country is not going to go back.
The difference between Native people still are sovereign nations. We still are citizens of our nations. We ratifying treaties with the United States. The Senate does not ratify treaties with anyone but the sovereign nations. We still exist. Under international law, you cannot treaties, you don't treaty away your existence. So we exist politically as sovereign nations. The U.S. government deals with us
so
as
what's the problem today then?
Yeah.
Because we want our treaties honored. The U.S. cannot flout international law.
You want your treaties
honored? Do we have something to do with that?
Yes, you have to return the land.
But that's not going to happen.
That's what Standing Rock
that's
is
not
about.
Gonna happen. You
So I just that little clip, I guess to me that shows that really it's, you know, one of the, there was a lot of Proud Boys at the protest on Saturday, and their whole idea is that they, their first vow they take is that they're not going to apologize for Western chauvinism, for the superiority of their culture and the sort of you know, American patriot focus. And I think this shows I mean, this was a Black Patriot Prayer supporter, but you know, it shows the huge gap in perspective.
Well, yeah, and I think just tying the question of perspective back to the larger question about, you know, this winning or not this PR war. I mean, to me, there's more at risk than good or bad PR. It's our lives in the face of open fascism and groups like the, you know, the Proud Boys, which are alt-light Western chauvinists who have been weaponized as the defense forces of fascists. So, you know, they're hiding behind the shield of so-called free speech when the reality is that, you know, there is no debating fascism. We have to resist it as fiercely as possible.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Clee Benally, an activist and anarchist. And you can find his pocket zine at indigenousaction.org. Film the police and know your rights. And please follow the case of Tracy Molina, a Native veteran who was arrested on Saturday at the Portland Patriot Prayer Rally. Thank you.
And if I may just recommend, like, folks look at the National Lawyers Guild website. They have a lot of great resources for preparing for actions, and also if you've been arrested or just understanding what your rights are, also the ACLU, American Civil Liberties Union, Midnight Special Law Collective, even though they're defunct, they have a lot of resources. Study AIM history, Black Panther Party history, MOVE history, and MUMIA. Also look at The Green Scare. There's a great book called Green is the New Red, looking at the criminalization of dissent and the treatment of activists or organizers as terrorists. And that's really part of the issue what we're facing. If we talk about legitimacy, anybody can be branded a terrorist these days, and then they're subject to extreme state repression. And that's really the environment that we're operating in. So it has to be resisted.
Great. All right. Thank you, Clee, so much. Yeah. Wishing. Oh, this is Jacqueline Keeler for Wednesday Talk Radio, and we are discussing the criminalization of Native dissent.